Mr. Barnett, Reel 2. We're talking about your time at Octu in Barmouth. And how did you and the rest of the cadets get on with the locals? You said there was a tad of friction in the bar because you weren't.
Oh, yes, well, that was just their thing to No, Welsh people, I took a great liking to Welsh people. And I got a great respect for Welsh women who cook in canteens, the best food I've ever had in sort of big scale cooking has been in Wales, strangely enough. First, when I was in the SDC at the college in Harlech, all the food there was terrific. And then there was a naffy in Barmouth, where we used to go on the way to church parade on Sundays. And they had fresh scones there, which of course food became paramount when you were a hungry young soldier, of course, and food and drink. And the food there was, for wartime, was brilliant, I thought. So the other, that reminded me, yes, the other case of that in Barmouth was, I don't know whether you know Barmouth, but there's a railway crossing in the middle of the town, the level crossing, and there's a footbridge over it. And under one end of the footbridge, underneath the staircase, there was a little kiosk which presumably sold ice cream or chocolates or something in peacetime. And a middle-aged woman and her daughter, a grown-up daughter, had taken it over and for making food for the troops. And they used to make what we used to call torpedoes, which were a sort of a Cornish pasta. And serve them hot to it. Even when you came off a night exercise at 2 o'clock in the morning, these two women were there serving torpedoes, and they were, of course, loved by the by the chaps, as you can imagine. That was very nice.
What
did the people were there?
What did you do for entertainment, generally?
Well, not a lot. I went to one or two chapels on Sunday, I remember, to listen to the singing, which of course was excellent. There must have been a cinema, but I can't recall it. I think there was a cinema. There was very little time, in fact, during the week. Sunday was a rest day. But I really can't recall either going bathing or doing anything other than perhaps just having an easy day.
Did your training include any element of how to behave as an officer and the sort of type of character you needed to be as an officer?
Well, I can't recall right now anything like that.
Sort of leadership and things like that and dealing with the men. Were you trained in that or was it just assumed?
I think it must have been assumed. I don't recall it. We had a huge RSM from the Coldstream Guards called COP. And it was said that a tank had run over his foot and had left him bad-tempered ever since. I don't know how true that was. And he was really rough on the parade ground. And he would place you at one end of the parade ground and your squad at the other end. You'd be six cadets facing six corps squads, and they had to try and determine with their backs to you who was shouting at whom. It was a trick to try and make you use a loud voice. Very difficult. But off duty, he was a charming man. Huge man. I remember his badge of rank was about the size of a dinner plate on his sleeve, and it was just at my eye level when I was standing alongside him. Always walked with a face stick across.
And what about standards of behaviour as an officer? Were you told about how you were expected to behave as an officer and gentleman, or was again
that? I can't really recall being told that. I think.
So it was just military training, there wasn't any.
No. Of course, it's a little bit difficult. I think standards of behaviour were generally in those days a little different than they are now, in that stratas were more well-defined between people in those days, perhaps, and accepted as such. I mean, we got war. We were distinguished by having a white bandage around our caps. And I think we took it upon ourselves to behave. We were rather pleased with ourselves, I suppose, to behave. It was kind of a cult to behave well and try and be an officer, you know, when you weren't.
What else did you do on your trip? You said the first month was very tough, and then, of course, yes. You were there about 6 months, yes. Through to September-ish.
Yes, after that it became enjoyable.
What sort of things did you move on to doing?
Well, we did quite a bit of driving, learning to drive various kinds of vehicles.
Could you drive before?
I could, yes, as it happened, but not many could in those days, of course, of my age. And I think we were in the minority, so I had a head start, which made it very enjoyable. We used to go out on motorbike training, which was the best fun. And we had, I think, about six at a time on matchless bikes up the mountain tracks, particularly where the instructors always knew where they did off-ration ham and eggs at the farm, you know. And they were most enjoyable, a little bit of a lark, really, but learning to ride motorbikes. And three-ton trucks we drove, which was good fun. And brain-gun carriers. But we never saw any... There were, across the river, across the estuary, there was a school of artillery. And... we could hear the guns, but we, to my regret, we never had anything to do with them.
What about other small arms? Did you get bayonet training? Or?
Yes, we did all that. Bayonet and rifle training. And
machine guns?
Brain guns. No medium machine guns. Nothing bigger than the brain.
What about submachine guns? Or?
Well, we didn't have any at all. There wasn't such a weapon. In those days.
Grenades?
And grenades, we threw some grenades. Not very much. We used pistols, but there didn't seem to be an abundance of ammunition. Whether there was or not, I don't know, but we could have done a lot more weapon training than we did. And I don't think at Oxford there was anything in the way of anti-tank weaponry of any kind. Of course, in France before that, the only weapon had been the boys' anti-tank rifle. We did have one of those and carried it, but never fired it. It was a useless weapon anyway, and terribly.
Did you already know that then? Because it was widely perceived.
It was despised, yes.
Now, so as the course went on, were you examined in any way at the end of it? How did they assess you? As to whether you passed your Op 2 course or not?
Yes, you could be assessed. And certainly, if you didn't pass the scratch, some people had to do an extra month. Of course, some people during the course were sent down.
What sort of thing would get you sent down?
I really don't know. I think lack of stamina, probably mostly. You had to... obviously have some character and drive. I think the sort of weak-willed, as you might call them, much of anything, were not accepted.
Did you worry about being sent back?
Yes, I think we did. We all did, I think. It was for the shame of it, really, rather than anything else. Not that we were trying to pass it to get on in life, as you might say. Just as well. And that's what really drives you in the army, as much as anything, generally speaking, is, you know, your shame of not supporting your fellow soldiers or being as good as they are. But once, actually, because you got terribly well, your physical condition became superb. No doubt about that at all. And that gave you tremendous confidence, you know, that about it. I know we just fit in the office, everyone is in the army, absolutely. In vulnerable in that area from exhausting, you know, wonderful feeling.
So, around about December, you'd finished the course, would it be?
Yes, it was after Christmas. In fact, I can't remember that Christmas. I'm not sure where I was, but it was just, I don't think I was home at Christmas. And then, of course, in the last month, you go to the military trail. This Thresher and Glennie had opened a shop in Bournemouth to be measured for a uniform, which was a great thrill. And you bought your kit in the way of folding camp bed and folding wash basin and a bedroll, those sort of things.
Did you get an allowance?
Yes, you did, and I can't recall what it was. I've got the feeling that either... No, I'm not really sure.
Did it cover your expenditure?
Just about, yes.
Did you have any worries about becoming an officer on the financial front?
Oh, no. Good Lord, no.
Mess bills and things, were you worried?
No. And it never actually... mess bills were never a problem.
Could you live on your wages? I mean, what you got paid?
Oh, yes. It was really pocket money, in a way. Mess bills were very small, because we were very rarely in a regular mess, of course, during the war.
So it's not having private means wouldn't have been an obstruction to being off?
No. It was wealth to me, from moving from nothing to... I think it was £4.10 a week was the pay of a lieutenant, which was great wealth for me.
So you got your new uniform and kitted out as an officer. Was there actually any ceremony where you passed out? Or?
There must have been. I can't recall the passing out parade. I think there was one, yes. We were all the staff came to see us off on the train, you know, and... It was a merry day.
Was there any question of picking the unit you went to, or could you...
Yes, you could. You asked which was your choice of regiment.
But it had to be infantry, wasn't it?
It had to be infantry, yes.
There's no question of you now asking to go to the Royal Infantry.
No, and I asked for the only regiment I knew of was from a local one, of course, which was the Lancashire Fusiliers, which I seem to remember was a heavy machine gun regiment. Anyway, I asked for them and was putting the gun right into it.
So you didn't get what you wanted?
Well, I have a theory now, having been back to reunions and seen the members of the regiment. I think they were chosen from their inside leg measurements. Because they're all about the same. Sure. And anyway, I was in the Devon.
Did you mind being... I mean,
not really, because I had no affiliation with any regiment. It was, I didn't mind at all.
So where were they when you went, when you were assigned to them?
Well, they were in Hornsey, I think. This was really cool. That was the first.
That's what's on the form, yes.
Is it? Yes.
And that was the 14th Battalion.
Yes.
You didn't have to report to the
I never went to
Brandsford.
Never went to Brandsford. No, never.
So you just went.
I went straight to the 14th, which were in Hornsey. Yes, that's like in a holiday camp, which had been a holiday camp of East Army, wouldn't have. And the officers' mess was in a brick building, a rather nice building. And the camp somewhere, and I can't remember the colonel's name, but he was even smaller than me, and I think he was a territorial, he was a solicitor, and he was a charming and very kind man.
Now what's that part of it, what sort of reception did they, or, you know, when you first joined, impression did they make?
It was sheer delight to me. I could understand how people made the army their home. It could have been a home to me, because the atmosphere was very pleasant. We were all good friends. There was no military formality in the officers' mess in the Durand ever, any of the battalion. In other regiments I was with were more formal, where you'd call company commander or captain sir, you know, if you were a lieutenant. In the Durhams, it was normal that the only person you called sir or colonel was the colonel. Everyone else was a Christian man, and it was really...
So even senior majors, when you were a very junior lieutenant...
A Christian man, yes. And it made for a very friendly mess. Yes, it was delightful. And also enjoyed the gentility of it all, whatever you like to call it. I mean, I recall in that Hornsey mess, we had a dining room, obviously, with one big table in it. There weren't many of us there, in fact. It wasn't a full battalion by any means.
It was a training battalion, wasn't it,
yeah,
at the time?
I think it was very short of men. I think there were only, at one time, there were only the cooks left, fortunately. But at breakfast time, we had, of course, stewards who came and served us, and each officer had his own teapot and toast rack, and it was all formal, but very, very pleasant, very civilised.
Were you given, did they have a new intake of men? What was the sort of role of the battalion?
No, it was a mess, really, a confusion, because I never really, being new to the army, of course, really, apart from training, I rather never really understood what was going on. I don't think anybody did. There was practically nothing to do. We were not there very long in Hornsey. Shortly afterwards, we moved. Not Hornsey. This was near Paignton.
Now, that's what Hornsey. Yes, that's incorrect.
So the first, sorry, where you joined them was near Paignton.
Paignton, near Torquay.
Right.
And then we...
That was the holiday camp then?
That's right.
Right. And how many men would be in the battalion at the time? What?
Very few. There were only the essential people to cook and keep the basic service going. There were no actual troops.
Would the training sergeants be there?
Hmm?
Would the sort of instructors be there?
Yes, perhaps. I don't know what there was in the NCO's mess. I have no recollection of it at all.
So when you were just there, you didn't really seem to have any duties at that time.
No, we didn't. There was nothing to do. Nothing we could do. We were idle, really. We must have done something with our days, but I can't remember what. And then we moved up to, very shortly afterwards, went by train overnight to Hornsey in
Yorkshire.
That
explains the
conflict. Sorry, that's wrong.
Right. And what happened there?
Well, we had a few men there, but mostly we were idle with nothing to do. We were again billeted in... formally, we were supposed to be guarding a length of about 3 miles of coastline. But with no men to do it with, I remember we had, the most I saw were about 9 a section. So we were idle most of the time. There were a number of officers there, but even not a full strength of the officers. And it was there that I met my two closest friends during my life, and that was Gift Putter, and Ronnie Sherlaw. Ronnie's still alive, I see him regularly, but Gift died 2 years ago. And it was there that I met them, and we were friends then for life. But
what were they like as officers? Well, you know.
It was lovely. And this was the curious thing about the preamble to going into a real battalion, is that I never had experience of having having a platoon of men. It was a bit wrong in that way, of course. The preparation for war was inadequate, to say the least. But it was very pleasant for a young chap.
Did you actually have any defensive positions on the coast?
No, we couldn't have. It was barbed wire, I remember. There was on the promenade a gentleman's lavatory, which contained some sort of gun. It was missing. We went in and had a look at it. It was rusty. It was missing. It was some sort of perhaps a navy gun or something. It was quite a small one for you, certainly. Had no breech block. So that if there'd been an attack on that coast, nothing would have prevented an incursion. But of course, the chances were so small in those days.
Was there any particular characters you mentioned? You mentioned
the two. No. Ian Bansell was a third friend I met there. I've forgotten him. He was killed during the war. I saw him once again during the war, briefly. He was killed. But, no, I can't remember anyone else. There were very few there. And then I can't really remember how long I was there. It can't have been very long.
And on your form, you say about February
1943.
So you'd be there about 2 or 3 months, you know, altogether.
No, I wasn't there as long as that.
So what happened then?
Well, we were slowly posted from there. Obviously, we were just somewhere for us to be, I think, until we got a posting. I was posted to the 1st 6th East Surrey Regiment. We were in a camp near Glasgow, battalion, I should say, ready for going to the Middle East. And they were very posh and very formal. I disliked being with them after the domes quite intensely.
When you went, did you remain a Durham Light Infantry officer? Did you keep your badge on?
Very deliberately, yes, because I didn't like to change. I even wore the Durhams have one unfortunate habit of wearing their forage caps on the centre of their head and instead of to one side, you know, which makes it a bit ludicrous, I think. But I even insist on doing that with make it clear that I wasn't really wanting to stay with them.
So what was it you disliked about them?
I disliked their military formality. I suppose they were probably a regular regiment. They were certainly very strict in the mess with the junior officers.
Can you give us some example? What was the mess?
There you had to call everybody was sir, other than another second lieutenant, which I thought was ridiculous. The food was brilliant, because they had mess silver and a very formal...
Had the Durhams used mess silver?
Well, not the 14th, that I don't, but my only experience, because it wasn't a regular regiment, you see.
First six wouldn't be regulars, though, would they?
I don't know.
It's usually a territorial number.
Is it? Well, they certainly were well equipped, and... The colonel, I remember, said that officers would have to leave their service dress at home. They couldn't go abroad with their take the service dress aboard, but he took it. And it was that sort of thing that I didn't like. Sort of class divisions in the mess.
Was there any other protocol attached to the mess?
I can't recall them now, but I can just remember not liking it.
What was your job in the battalion?
It was very brief, of course.
Were you given?
I had nothing. I didn't have a platoon. I was happened to me again. There were two of us attached to this battalion from other regiments. The other one was, and we made firm friends, of course, because we were the two outsiders. The other captain's name was Smith, and he was from a South Country regiment, but not very serious. We were a good friend. And then we were only there a day or were shipped onto the Orion, I put here. I think it was probably the Orion. To go to, we didn't know where, but in Greenock.
And that was a troop ship?
A troop ship, yeah.
What was the journey like?
Well, there again, it was a lovely experience. My first experience abroad, of course, or on a ship for that matter. For officers, it was very comfortable because we had the first class accommodation, although there were a lot of us. But the food was out of this world on a good class passenger ship because the kitchens are still working, and of course they presumably got their supplies from foreign ports. It was absolutely peacetime best, with lavish breakfasts, coffee and freshly baked buns at 11 o'clock, and a choice of menus at lunchtime, and then afternoon tea and dinner. You know, you just couldn't cope with it without having some exercise. That was difficult to get eating it all. So it was very, the trip was very entertaining to me, I must say. I enjoyed it enormously. And we went, one odd thing there was that we were anchored at offshore in Greenock for a week before we sailed, waiting for the convoy to collect the jewelry. And it was said that one of the chaps could see his wife in the garden on shore.
And what route did you take?
Well, we went straight out into the mid-Atlantic, straight out westwards, and then southwards, and eastwards back into Gibraltar, which I think it took about a fortnight. Long time, you know, long journey. And then eventually anchored off Algiers. Which another thrill for me. I must say, I fell in love with the Mediterranean from that moment we anchored off Algiers. Wonderful place. Lovely climate. And the smell coming off shore from Algiers was marvellous, because as you know, when you're at sea, you lose all the perfumes of land, and they seem very strong when you get back again. And it was different, of course, even though it was early in the year, than England, stronger, and quite delightful, I thought. And then we went ashore at Algiers and marched to, I don't know where it is, anyway, a sort of cape, about 18 miles from Algiers, and we were in buttonless, khaki serge uniforms, and it was getting warm, so we were a bit stressed carrying all our kit and weapons. And
it's a fair march.
It was a fair march, yes. We were a bit exhausted when we got there into a transit camp. And I did get it, while we were there, I did get into Algiers once or twice, and I thought it was a very pleasant city indeed.
Now, were you actively trying to leave the East Surreys? How did you go about trying to get out?
Well, being reserve officers, the two of us were left behind when the battalion moved out. We were to follow them, you see, up into the line. And when you're doing that, you're moved from transit camp to transit camp, you know, and
as reserve officer, you were just waiting for someone to be killed, were you, presumably?
Yeah. Moving up all the time, but behind the battalion. And in one of the camps we were in, I thought, well, I'll try and get out. I went to see the adjutant, and I said, are there any Durhams in the line? And he said, oh, yes, the 16th. So I said, can I get transferred to them? He said, no problem. Just like that. Never saw the Surreys again to my relief.
So what happened when you got that? That was in March 43. So it wasn't long before that happened. What happened when you joined the 16th then? Where exactly were they?
Well, the war was about finished, the North African campaign, when I got to them. They were in the line and somewhere near Medjus, Sedjanine, which was the battle, I think the last battle they had there, was finished. So I never really saw any action there. Shortly after I arrived, as far as I can recall, we came out of the line that the campaign was over. The Italians had given themselves up in the thousands, and the Germans. And presumably we were moving back to some camp or other, but we were just out in the scrub, the time was, in its units. I didn't have a platoon. Still didn't have a platoon. And before we got anywhere, I remember we had a service, a religious service, and that was Padre Meek, who was referred to in Dr. Jones's notes there. He was very nice fellow indeed. And I can remember the service. It was quite moving, of course, and everybody was in a very light-hearted mood with the campaign being finished, as you can imagine. And
What was your assessment of the condition of the battalion? I mean, you weren't an expert soldier. I mean, what did you think of them when you joined them? I mean, what did you think of their condition and morale?
Well, of course,
morale?
I was very relieved to be with Northerners again, so I was very happy, and they were all happy, of course, and they were all they'd been together, of course, quite a long time, most of them, so they were all good friends. Oh, there was nothing but friendship and...
So the officer's mess was as welcoming as the 14th?
Well, there wasn't a mess there, you see, then.
But the officers were?
Oh, yes, yes.
And they were equally informal, were they?
Yes.
Operate?
Yes, they were. Johnny Preston was then the CO.
What was he like?
Oh, delightful man. He was a KOLI regiment, really. But he'd only been, I found out later, of course, didn't know the time, only been in command of it only a short time. But he was a very friendly and delightful man.
Any other characters then that you particularly...
It was, there again, a very brief time with them at that then, because we never, to my memory, I can't remember beyond coming out of the line and having a sort of free time in no camp with no tents or anything, just living in the brush and in the scrubland that formed that part of North Africa. There was a big boar pig ran through across the ground at one stage, I remember, and I think a sergeant major out of my sight shot it, and they tried to butcher it because it hadn't done anything. And it was so lousy they didn't eat it. But I was then. What happened to me next was that I was sent off on a course in mine warfare at a sappers school. And I can't recall where it was, but it was in North Africa, obviously. And that was for a month, if I remember rightly. And I enjoyed that enormously because this was about booby traps and mines, obviously.
What sort of things were they teaching you, if you can
remember?
Well,
they were teaching us how to recognise booby traps and mines, how to disarm them, how they worked, how to use ours, and the types of mine we'd be expected to find, both German and Italian.
And do you remember in any more detail each part of that? I mean, how did you recognise?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was quite fascinated. And, of course, we were taught on how to dispose of mines or unexploded bombs or anything with charges. So there I learned about explosives and the use of explosives, and mechanical devices such as mines and booby traps, and I found it most interesting and enjoyable. And I started a collection of fuses and odd items of foreign German and Italian devices at that time, which I had quite a collection of in there. I've still got a few now.
So how would you recognise a booby trap? Well, what were you looking for?
Well, there are things like mostly booby traps on the ground, of course, like tripwires, or the most frightening weapon the Germans had in that was what they call an S mine, which was a canister about the size of a big tin of fruit with an exploded charge in the middle, an outer container which contained about 150 ball bearings, and a fuse on the top, which was either only buried this in the ground, leaving just the three wire prongs of the fuse above ground. That's all that was seen. So it was virtually invisible. If you stepped on it, there was a pause of a second or two, and then this thing was ejected from the ground and exploded about 5 feet in the air. It was a murderous device, and it could also have be connected to a tripwire, of course, so that it could go off, in pairs or more. And it was said that on one of the hills that we made an attack on, after the battle, the engineers, the sappers, cleared it of something like 50,000 of these S mines that had been buried. But that might have been a story, because the story like that did go around and around.